From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Arthur Ashe made it to the top of the tennis world, but in his case, he faced more than the physical challenge. As a black man, he also had to fight racism. On this edition of Fresh Air, Arthur Ashe talks about the history of the black athlete in America. Also today, we examine how Shakespeare went from a playwright to a cultural icon. Shakespearean scholar Gary Taylor's new book examines how each generation has reinvented Shakespeare to match the values of the day. Rock historian Ed Ward takes us back to the beginning of the British punk movement, and book critic John Leonard reviews The Shawl, Cynthia Ozick's story of a Holocaust survivor's difficulties living with her own memories of the Holocaust. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Puerto Rican National Guardsmen with automatic rifles patrolled San Juan today to prevent looting after Hurricane Hugo devastated the island, leaving 27,000 people homeless and causing food shortages. All told, Hugo is blamed for taking at least 19 lives in the Eastern Caribbean. The Pentagon says Hugo caused serious damage to a U.S. military facility in the Caribbean. Spokesman Fred Hoffman told reporters Hugo's winds heavily damaged Roosevelt Roads Naval Station at the eastern tip of Puerto Rico and the Air Force Satellite Tracking Station on Antigua. The America's Cup will once again reside in the United States thanks to a decision by the state's appeals court in New York. Matt Edelson has details.
In a battle that's been fought in the high courts as often as the high seas recently, the Appellate Division of New York's Supreme Court issued a decision which will strip New Zealand of yachting's most prestigious award. The court concluded that New York Justice Carmen Chaparek was in error when she gave the cup to New Zealand in April of this year. Even though the American catamaran Stars and Stripes defeated New Zealand in races held off San Diego last September, Justice Chaparek had ruled that the American boat was inherently faster, thus violating the spirit of the 138-year-old race, and awarded the cup to New Zealand. The court voted 4-1 today to reverse that decision and send the cup back to the San Diego Yacht Club. For National Public Radio, I'm Matt Edelson.
A French airliner with 154 people on board has disappeared on a flight between the Congo and France. The DC-10 belonging to the company UTA was last heard from 20 minutes after it took off from an airport in Chad. Roger Morier has more from Paris.
UTA's flight 772 left the Chadian capital on a routine flight in mid-afternoon, taking off into clear skies. Shortly thereafter, the plane disappeared from the radar screens. There are 140 passengers and 14 crew members on board the plane. Reports say that among the passengers is the wife of the American ambassador to Chad and a senior Chadian government minister. A French military plane has left Senegal to join other military planes from neighboring countries looking for the DC-10. The French embassy in Algiers says the UTA plane probably went down in the Mediterranean between Algeria and the Italian island of Sardinia, but there is no confirmation of this. UTA says the DC-10 in question is 16 years old and had last been given a complete overhaul 2 years ago. The company is not ruling out the possibility that the plane might have been hijacked. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Maurier in Paris.
The Colombian government today issued arrest warrants for two Israelis accused of training hit squads for drug cartels waging war on the government of Colombia. Officials at the Israeli embassy in Bogota and the foreign ministry in Jerusalem said Israel has no extradition treaty with Colombia. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was fractionally lower. The Dow closed at 2687.31. This is NPR News. Lawyers for Iran-Contra defendant Richard Secord said today that prosecutors made an irreparable mistake by failing to get Justice Department permission before launching a perjury probe of Secord's testimony to Congress. U.S. District Court Judge Aubrey Robinson said Secord is raising significant legal issues, but he rejected as too time-consuming an attempt to delay the trial. Fire officials blame arsonists for a fire that destroyed 1,700 acres of Israeli forest today. Linda Granstein reports.
The fire has been raging for over 10 hours in northern Israel, but Israeli firefighters say it is almost under control. At about noon, the blaze broke out in five different places simultaneously, and Police Minister Chaim Bar-Lev said he has no doubt it was arson, presumably connected to the Arab uprising in the territories. He said several suspects were arrested and over 1,700 acres of trees on the slopes of Mount Carmel were destroyed, some of them over 100 years old. Residents of Kibbutz Beit Orin were evacuated, and 10 hikers in the forest were treated for smoke inhalation. An Arabic-speaking man phoned Israel Radio and said his organization, Direct Revenge, was responsible for the blaze. An Israeli official said it was by far the largest arson incident in recent years. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Vatican said today a convent on the site of the Auschwitz death camp that offended Jewish groups should be moved, and that the Vatican would help pay to construct a new prayer center outside the camp. The statement was the first public declaration by the Roman Catholic Church hierarchy. The controversy has severely strained Catholic-Jewish relations. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev said today the next Communist Party Congress would be moved forward to October of 1990. The announcement is seen as a clear move to revive the party's leadership, depleted ranks to revive the ranks with fresh talent. He addressed the party's policymaking central committee. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've postponed our discussion challenging some of the current medical advice on cholesterol until tomorrow. Our guest today is tennis star Arthur Ashe. He's written a history of the African-American athlete called A Hard Road to Glory. Ashe writes, discrimination, vilification, incarceration, dissipation, ruination, and ultimate despair have dogged the steps of the mightiest of these athletes. I spoke with Ashe about his own hard road to glory. Ashe started competing in tennis in the 1950s when the courts in his home state of Virginia were still segregated and the world of professional tennis was, for all practical purposes, a white world. Ashe became the first black man to win the U.S. Open and Wimbledon. His playing career ended at the age of 36 in 1980 after a heart attack and quadruple bypass surgery. Since that time, he served as captain of the U.S. Davis Cup team and national campaign chairman for the American Heart Association. Arthur Ashe has written several books, including an autobiography and a tennis diary called Portrait in Motion. He got drawn into writing a history of black athletes when he discovered how little was written on the topic. As he did his research, he came upon many stereotypes that have been used against blacks in sports.
The strongest health stereotype was in baseball. Mm-hmm. No question about that. Baseball emerged very quickly as the national pastime, followed closely by football after a while. But in baseball, the players and some owners went to great lengths to keep blacks out, and the stereotypical reason was that they were not good enough or were afraid. For instance, even in boxing, one of the reasons that Jim Corbett, back in the late 1890s, and John L. Sullivan gave for not fighting blacks is that they had a yellow streak. And obviously Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion, put all this to rest. But that was what people wanted to believe, and it was chiefly as a result of stereotypes publicized about in magazines and newspapers.
You've written that, like most blacks, you grew up believing that a lot of jobs were off-limits for blacks. What about sports, and specifically what about tennis?
Well, when I became 10, 11, 12 years old. We're talking about the early to mid-50s now. The color line had been broken in the major team sports. There was already a broken line of sorts in boxing and track, but it had not been broken until that period between 1946 and 1950 in basketball, football, baseball, tennis, golf, bowling, and some others. And so I was a sports nut as a child and able to follow the exploits of a Jackie Robinson or Althea Gibson. And in that respect, I was quite fortunate. But not knowing that had I been born just 2 or 3 years earlier, that would not have been the case.
How did tennis become your sport?
I was always a very good little athlete. I was fast and I was quick, but I was not very big.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not going to play football. I wasn't tall enough to really do that well in basketball. I learned how to swim at a very early age, but was not that interested. Soccer was not popular yet. And I also played tennis, I think, because it was not a team sport. It was just me by myself out there alone. And I also, in addition, believe that I gravitated towards sports and books as a way to get over the death of my mother, which occurred when I was just 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I think books and sports may have saved me from going slightly nuts.
You've pointed out that when you were coming of age, blacks really had no identification with the sport of tennis. And I was wondering if that was ever an obstacle to your appreciation of the sport.
Not really. I knew who the black sports heroes were in the field of tennis. People like Jimmy McDaniel. Of course, we were all aware of Althea Gibson and very proud of her for having blazed the trail. And I knew some of the other very good black players. But all of us knew that we wanted to play at Forest Hills, or wanted to play in the Davis Cup, or wanted to play at Wimbledon. And in the late 40s, that was just not possible. But that didn't stop us from wanting to realize our dreams in any event.
Did anyone ever try to discourage you and tell you that there was very little room for black players in the sport?
No. Not discouragement to the extent of saying stop because there's only so high you can go, no. But it was certainly pointed out that there were no, with the exception of Althea, there were no black role models that you could point to that had gone as far as she had gone, especially no men, no men at all, completely none.
It's funny because it's usually the opposite way, right?
Yes, yes, in most sports. Yes, that's exactly right. But and it's still that way today. That is, to the extent that there may be more black participation in the sport like in a sport like tennis in the future, I think most of the participation in the next decade or so will be females rather than males.
If you're just joining us, my guest is tennis star Arthur Ashe, who retired from the sport a few years ago after quadruple bypass. He has just written a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete, and it's called A Hard Road to Glory. Tennis is the sport perhaps most associated with the upper class, and I think that perhaps in black tennis and in white tennis, when you were starting out, that a lot of the players were from well-to-do families.
Yes, that also made a huge difference as far as tennis was concerned. I also think it has a lot to do with the longevity of the American Tennis Association, for instance, which is the black national body that has held black tennis together since 1916. I mean, the American Tennis Association has the longest history of any other black American sports body in continuous operation. The only other one would be the athletic conference that ties together the schools and the Central Intercollegiate Athletic Association, which was begun in 1912. But the reason I say that is implied in your question, and that is because most of the people who played were college graduates. They were members of the very small but influential black professional class.
Well, you are from the middle class, and your father was a police officer.
My family was lower middle class, and there's mm-hmm. no question. My father had a 6th-grade education, but had a very respectable job, and we were not poor by any means.
But did that make you something of an outsider, even in the world of black tennis?
No. Uh-huh. There was a pretty good mix, but almost all of the officers and the people who had positions of authority in black tennis in the American Tennis Association, almost all of them were college graduates. Almost all of them, and they all played. And they just saw to it that they were going to keep this group going, keep the tournaments going, and they did. But there were many players from other countries, for instance. There are a lot of Panamanians, black Panamanians, who came up to play. There are some from the Caribbean who came to play. And quite a few of those who are influential were first and second generation Americans from the West Indies. The West Indian influence was quite pronounced.
Because of the class associations with the game, when did you have to learn a certain code of behavior associated with the upper classes?
No, we adopted the same code of ethics that the white tennis body used, and that code was steeped in Victorian English tradition.
Uh-huh.
And we went along with it, but it made sense, especially since the principles that one would hear, the moral codes that one would hear in the black church, would be very similar to what is espoused by Victorian England. Modesty, obey the Ten Commandments, honor your father and your mother, don't do anything that would embarrass your family. And I don't think black tennis players had any difficulty adhering to that.
You were the first black to win many of the titles that you won. You were the first black to win the Junior Davis Cup, the first black to get a UCLA tennis scholarship, the first black to win Wimbledon. I think the first also to win...
Black man.
Black man, okay, right.
Yes.
Also the same for the U.S. Open. What were some of the pressures that went along with being the first black or first black man to win some of these titles?
Well, the pressures were more closely associated with certain time periods.
Uh-huh.
I felt enormous pressure in the 60s because that was the decade of the era of the black social revolution. That's when Dr. King started his crusades, and you had your sit-ins and your freedom rides and trips, summer trips to Selma, Alabama, and you had the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act coming into being in 64 and 65. And Malcolm X was in his heyday, and the Vietnam War, and Muhammad Ali refusing to cross the line for induction to the U.S. Army, and Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists at Mexico City at the Olympics. So against the background, the context of the 1960s, I felt enormous pressure to contribute to black social progress. In the 1970s, it all but disappeared. Any pressure one may have felt then, anybody black may have felt, was self-inflicted, self-imposed almost. It just completely disappeared. And now there's very little pressure to do anything, especially when compared with the era of the 1960s.
Do you think that's good or bad?
Well...
Or neither.
I'm sort of ambivalent about it.
Uh-huh.
There's no question I think it helped. No matter who you were or what endeavor your expertise was in, if you had any degree of fame at all, you were expected to participate in the 1960s. And you were even badgered into it almost in ways of trying to prove that you were blacker than somebody else. You know, your afro was bigger than your dashiki was more African than the next black person's. That just completely disappeared in the 70s. And I can't find it at all in the 80s. And we know the reasons, but it's just sad to see it completely disappear because everybody now seems a bit more self-centered than they were before.
Mm-hmm. So you think some of those pressures that went along with the 60s were somewhat superficial, but on the other hand, you wish things were a little more political today?
Well, not so much superficial as someone like myself and quite a few people being in a position where if you were from the South, you were legally proscribed from doing a lot of things by whites.
Mm-hmm.
And here you were in the 60s being pressured into doing things by blacks who were in so-called leaders, positions of responsibility and influence. And you came to the point where you wanted to ask yourself, well, when do I get a chance to make up my own mind about something?
Uh-huh.
That's the situation I felt most deeply. All my life, up until I left school to go to college in California, I had whites telling me what I could and could not do, where I could and could not go. And all of a sudden, in the decade of the 60s, you have your black militants and other black leaders telling me what I should do solely because I'm black. And again, I would like to be able to make that decision for myself if I could once in life. But as far as tennis was concerned, for instance, the one area where I felt this tug both ways was in the issue of dealing with South Africa.
Yeah.
I was told in 1968 that if I wanted to go play in the South African Open, they probably wouldn't let me go because they don't allow blacks to play down there. Now, that had happened to me all my life as a junior in my own hometown, and I was in the position of saying, well, I'll be damned if that'll happen to me as a senior player. And when I wanted to go down there, you run into the opposition by some other blacks who say, you can't go down there because if you do, you'll be lending credence and credibility to that system. But I was just trying to prove a point that, hey, here's a country that said I can't play, and my position was, you either let me play or your tournament doesn't count. One of the two. Take your pick.
Mm-hmm. Athletes really have to be very single-minded to develop their abilities. And I'm wondering if it was hard for you to figure out how to divide your energies between civil rights actions that you participated in or speaking out on behalf of certain issues and devoting your time to your sport.
Very difficult, very difficult. I got in trouble once when I was stationed at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. I was an officer there and second lieutenant, and I made a speech in a black church in Washington that the Army thought was a bit too political. It was covered in the Washington Post, and I was called into the superintendent's office and told in no uncertain terms that if you do that again, you're going to be grounded, meaning we wouldn't be allowed to go out to play Davis Cup or whatever. Yet, you felt almost duty-bound to say something. Things were at such a fever pitch in 1968. That was the year, of course, when Dr. King was assassinated. That's when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. That's when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists. And looking back on it, I don't regret it at all, even though I know Army regulations forbid anybody in the Army from engaging in political activity. But you just felt almost compelled to say something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your life in tennis and your life since retiring from tennis. But first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Arthur Ashe, who has just written a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete. It's called A Hard Road to Glory. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Arthur Ashe has just completed a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete called A Hard Road to Glory. Ashe himself is one of those athletes to travel that hard road to glory. He was the first black American male to win Wimbledon and to win many other tennis championships. He retired from playing in 1980 after quadruple bypass surgery. You've pointed out in your autobiography that when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in tennis, when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball, there were a lot of black baseball players who were already excellent players playing in the black leagues and waiting to break in. So there was just the gates opened and there were great players right afterwards. But in tennis, it was different. There weren't as many black tennis players. So after you helped break the color barrier, there weren't as many black tennis players coming right in.
No, there weren't. In actual fact, to go back to the first half of your question, there were many more black, talented, capable players who could have played in the major leagues than were allowed to play. The major leagues let in black players after Jackie Robinson almost as if they were coming through a sieve. It was very, very slow. The first 14 years could be best described as token integration of the major leagues. Now, in tennis, there were two problems. One is that there was no huge black American history of having quite a few heroes, say like a Satchel Paige or Josh Gibson or Oscar Charleston, that the average black American had known about as far as baseball was concerned. There was no one who had tested their skills against white tennis players, and it was publicized in the paper. You have to remember that at the end of each season, for a long time, all-star aggregations of white major league players would get together and play against black teams to full houses around the country. And in most of these confrontations, the black teams almost inevitably won, and it garnered tremendous publicity, positive, for the black players. Now, that never happened in tennis, with the exception of one time in 1938, Don Budge came to Harlem to the Cosmopolitan Tennis Club and played an exhibition match against a current black champion, Jimmy McDaniel. And Budge won very handily and then played a doubles match afterwards. But that's the only instance where the best black players played at a very public venue against the best white players. And as such, black America just was never able to establish the momentum to produce enough tennis players to follow right behind Althea Gibson when she opened the door in 1950.
Well, I'm thinking, too, for instance, like all schoolyards have basketball hoops, you know, in most schoolyards or in vacant lots, you can play baseball. There aren't that many tennis courts around in cities, especially, I think that's true, in black neighborhoods.
Well, there are tennis courts, but most of the expertise and the competitions are oriented toward the other team sports. And there's one very strong reason for that, and that is because those are the sports that are stressed in the public school systems.
Mm-hmm.
The public schools have four major sports: football, basketball, baseball, and track. All but track are team sports per se. Track is organized and run as a team competition, when in fact the performances are by individuals. And one of the reasons to do that, the chief reason, is that it's the best use of scarce athletic space. Now, a tennis court is 120 by 60, and you only get two people on it, and it takes a lot of space. So unless you live in Texas or California or Arizona where there's a lot of space, that's just not going to happen in a place like New York City,
mm-hmm.
where you have to resort to private facilities. And the best teaching is not to be found at your public park or your public school, as it is for basketball or baseball. It's to be found at a private club, which means you got to pay for it. And when you have to pay for it, that in effect becomes a barrier, an economic barrier to progress.
You gave up tennis in 1980 after
Yes.
a heart attack and then quadruple bypass surgery. What are you able to do now athletically?
Oh, I stay fit. I mean, if one were to see me in person, I don't look any bigger than I did in 1980. I ride an exercise bike. I think the athlete in me left enough vanity for me not to get a pot belly or to get completely out of shape aerobically. So I'm still looking about the same as I did then.
You've said that you've worked for the Heart Association.
Yes,
headed up a campaign for them. Yeah,
right.
Well, you've said that most people who die of heart attacks die because they haven't gotten quick enough attention. They deny they're having a heart attack. They think it's indigestion or something. That's actually what happened to you.
Yes, if that is exactly what happened to me, and if it hadn't been for the doctor there, Dr. Lee Wallace, who just noticed my discomfort and asked some questions, I may have just sat there and died in the chair, for all I know. But he just very politely but firmly insisted that I come to the hospital with him, never mentioning the phrase heart attack at all. And, of course, we found out 2 days later, after they've done the enzyme tests and got the results back, that I indeed had had a heart attack. But, yes, in my work with the American Heart Association, it is stressed by cardiologists all over the country that the key to surviving a heart attack is not to deny that you have it, but get to a hospital, emergency room, and if there are no trauma cases, no gunshot wounds or knifings on the table, heart attack suspects go right to the front of the line.
Did you feel mentally prepared to retire from tennis?
Oh, yes. I was 36 years old, so it's not as if I felt cheated by this physical disability. No, not at all. I was probably going to retire at the end of that year anyway.
One last thing, can you still play tennis?
Oh, I can, but I don't. I hardly ever play. My wife will drag me out every once in a while and play. And I'll tell you one thing about it, though. Your hands and your arms never forget. If someone were to just casually watch me play now, and I may play twice a year, you would think that I never stopped playing. But once they see me run, they'll understand that I've stopped a long time ago.
Do you not play for health reasons or for other reasons?
Basically health reasons. My heart situation is such that I really can't fully go all out to play. So if I can't do that, then I'd rather just not play at all.
Arthur Ashe, his 3-volume history of the African-American athlete is a hard road to glory. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, our postponed discussion on cholesterol, investigative journalist Thomas Moore will challenge current medical claims that a low cholesterol diet and cholesterol-reducing drugs can lengthen your life. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Gary Taylor is an editor of the Oxford edition of The Complete Works of Shakespeare, but his new book is about Shakespeare's changing image since the 17th century, how each generation has reinvented Shakespeare to fit with the times. Coming up, what society has done in the name of Shakespeare. Also, rock critic Ed Ward takes us through the evolution of the London punk scene, from the Sex Pistols to Susie and the Banshees. And book critic John Leonard reviews Cynthia Ozick's new book, The Shawl. It combines two previous works to tell the story of a survivor's life in shambles decades after the Holocaust. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. About 100 striking United Mine workers are still barricaded inside a coal preparation plant in southwestern Virginia. The miners have occupied the control room of the Pittston coal plant since Sunday. Donna Peck of member station WVTF in Roanoke reports that they are protesting a lack of bargaining progress in the five-month-old strike.
Thousands of union supporters and hundreds of state troopers mingled around the Pittston plant today. The strikers' occupation of the plant has effectively shut down Pittston operations and is reportedly costing the company $1 million a day in lost coal production. A federal judge will rule tomorrow on whether to order state police in to move the miners out of the plant. Meantime, a state judge today levied another $3.4 million in fines against the union for violating strike guidelines. Judge Donald McLaughlin has now fined the UMW over $25 million and set a September 26 deadline for the union to pay up. A UMW spokeswoman says the union doesn't know where it's going to get that kind of money in a week. For National Public Radio, I'm Donna Peck in Roanoke, Virginia.
Housing Secretary Jack Kemp today conceded that the federal government has a poor record on helping the homeless, but promised that he would end cumbersome and obstructive practices. In a speech today, Kemp unveiled a new homeless program that provides health care services paid for by private funds. Melissa Mancini of Connecticut Public Radio has the story.
Housing Secretary Jack Kemp says he wants to shut down every welfare hotel and motel in the country and provide decent housing for homeless families. In a speech in Hartford today, Kemp said it should be a group effort.
I recognize that government can't do it alone. We can't expect churches and synagogues to do it alone. We've got to have those public-private partnerships.
Kemp, along with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, announced a joint multi-million-dollar program designed to provide housing and services such as health care, drug treatment, and child care to homeless families. The Homeless Families Program will provide 8 cities nationwide with foundation grants for health care, while the federal government could kick in as much as $7 million worth of Section 8 housing. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini.
Hurricane Hugo continues on its uncertain path as it moves past the Bahamas. The killer storm leaves in its wake at least 19 deaths and thousands of people without homes. Military planes are carrying radios, drinking water, generators and other equipment to stricken areas that are calling for more help. Weather forecasters are warning people living from Florida to North Carolina that the powerful storm could threaten them by Friday. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down less than a point to close at 2,687.31 in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In 1976, punk rock erupted in London, set off first by a visit from Patti Smith and later the Ramones. British punk brought with it a slew of do-it-yourself record labels, fan magazines, and new fashions. The Sex Pistols may be the best known of the London punk bands, but rock and roll historian Ed Ward says they weren't the only group worth listening to.
By cause I It was 14 years ago, and England was coming off of a very bad summer. Unemployment was up, racial incidents were erupting in the bigger cities, and it seemed like everybody was walking around with a chip on their shoulder. Everybody was presumably too self-absorbed, the way you get in situations like that, to notice that something momentous was about to happen. But in London, if you'd looked around, there were clues. A small clique of journalists from the New Musical Express, a weekly pop paper, and a number of very odd musicians were playing music in various configurations. Journalist Nick Kent had been to New York and had seen what was going on there, so he and a guy named Chris Miller, who called himself Rat Scabies, formed a band, the Subterraneans. Kent went back to writing shortly thereafter, but the band stayed together, added another New Musical Express writer, Chrissy Hind, and found a manager, Malcolm McLaren, who ran a boutique. By the time 1976 had dawned, the band was changing yet again, and as the coldest winter in recent memory faded away, they'd solidified into something truly scary.
I got a feeling inside of me. It's kind of strange, like a stormy sea. I don't know why, I don't know why. I guess these things have got to be. I've got a new rose, I've got a good. Guess I knew that I always would. I can't stop to mess around. I got a brand new rose in town.
They were called the Damned, and their bass player, Captain Sensible, wore a dress. Their lead singer wore suits and painted his face white to look like Dracula, and they drove London kids crazy. New Rose, which was produced by an old pub rocker named Nick Lowe, became the first blast of what would soon be known as punk rock. It had the energy of a classic Who record, but the Who's old audience was scandalized, which was the point, although I doubt anybody thought it would be that easy. The Damned's ex-manager, Malcolm McLaren, fired the next shot a month later with the Sex Pistols' Anarchy in the UK, and bands started appearing daily. Half of the Damned had played in a band called the London SS, and that band had mutated into one of the most popular of the new groups.
Wild Ryan, I wanna ride. Wild Ryan, I ride on my own. Wild Ryan, I wanna ride. Wild Ryan, I ride on my own. Black man got a lot of problems, but they don't mind for the break. White people go to school, but they teach you how to be big.
The Clash were political, the Sex Pistols nihilists, and the Damned just good goofy fun. Naturally, with so many allies in the press, they got lots of publicity, and pretty soon kids all over England wanted to form punk rock bands and move to London. In Bromley, just outside of London, there were Susan Dalion, Steve Havoc, and William Broad, suburban kids in revolt. One night on stage at the 100 Club, Susie and Steve became Susie and the Banshees. As for William Broad, his new band was the first to play at London's top punk club, the Roxy. They were called Generation X, and Broad called himself Billy Idol. Just to make sure they made history, their first single was an answer record of sorts to The Who's old anthem.
Trying to forget your generation.
The great thing about the punk movement in London was its egalitarianism. In a rock scene that seemed divided forever between ostentatious royalty like Rod Stewart, the man the punks loved to hate, and hundreds of bands still playing the same beery joints, punk attracted upper-middle-class art students like the group Wire.
One, two, X, you!
At the same time, it was giving opportunities for such working class kids as 999. And this was just London. In the provinces, bands like Warsaw, The Buzzcocks, The Fall, and many others geared up for their moment in the limelight. It was the start of rock and roll's last great burst of optimism, of do-it-yourself. It's hard to believe that it was actually 13 years ago that most of this music was recorded, and it's weird to feel nostalgic about it, that's for sure.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
We talk about the whys and wherefores, do we really care at all? Talk about the frailty of words, is really meaningful. When we're sitting watching the planes burn up through the night like meteorites. We're just poor teenagers, luminous emotional agents. Poor teenagers, see ourselves as strangers. Poor teenagers.
This is Fresh Air. Shakespeare's reputation as the greatest literary figure of all time rarely comes into question. Gary Taylor's new book, Reinventing Shakespeare, puts the bard's reputation on the line. Taylor himself is a Shakespeare scholar who has furthered the accessibility of Shakespeare's work. Taylor's Shakespearean books stack up more than 1 foot high. He co-edited a new Oxford edition of Shakespeare's complete works and wrote several books of interpretation. Taylor says it's time to investigate Shakespeare's literary supremacy and to see how each succeeding generation has reinvented the man and his works to suit the times. I asked Gary Taylor what kind of reaction he expected from other Shakespeare scholars if he questioned Shakespeare's reputation.
Well, I knew that a lot of my colleagues wouldn't appreciate it very much. This is one of the factors that contributes to the maintenance of a reputation like this. You get a kind of professional inertia because you've got a very large body of people who make a living out of declaring that Shakespeare is enormously important. And those are the people who tend to know most about him, but they're also the people who are perhaps least objective because they have a... I mean, obviously they wouldn't have devoted so much of their time and their lives and their energies to studying this artist if they didn't think very highly of him. And so that those are the people who almost by definition find it most difficult to look objectively at his achievement as against the achievement of other great writers.
Because to challenge his achievement is to challenge the importance of their interpretation.
That's right. And what they would rather do, the kinds of challenging that go on in our profession, and people are always arguing with each other, is to challenge other people's interpretations. But, of course, that doesn't in any way challenge whether the work is worth interpreting in the first place or how important it is that we interpret it by comparison with other writers in English or other writers in other languages who might be equally interesting and important.
You say that the study of Shakespeare has been in turmoil since the 70s. How?
Well, in a lot of different ways. This is, I think, one of those periods when we're moving from one sort of dominant interpretation to another. The turmoil has been created by the rise of feminist criticism, by the rise of Marxist and semiotic criticism, and by major changes in our interpretation of how Shakespeare's texts were created. The acceptance that Shakespeare revised his work, just like other writers and dramatists do, has led to lots of changes in our understanding of just what the bare text is that Shakespeare wrote in the first place, let alone how we interpret it. And there is an agreement on the kind of general principles by which we should interpret works. Feminist and Marxist and semiotic criticism don't just challenge particular interpretations of one play or one line. They challenge the whole way that we interpret any work of literature. So that... this creates a great deal of anxiety and rancor within the profession about how we should go about doing our business.
Teachers and many scholars want us to believe that Shakespeare's insights into character can be relevant in spite of all the changes that have happened through the centuries. Yet a lot of students resist reading Shakespeare because the language is difficult to penetrate because of its, you know, more archaic constructions. A lot of students find him sexist or elitist. How much do you think it's worth updating Shakespeare or changing the language or, you know, reinterpreting Shakespeare to make it more relevant and comprehensible to people today? Do you know what I mean? Do you leave the work alone and say that's the work? If you don't like it, fine. Or do you keep trying to change it so it has some meaning to people in the present?
Well, there are two different ways of approaching the problem. It is a problem, and it's become more and more of a problem. One of the curious things about the history of Shakespeare's reputation is that the very point at which he starts becoming compulsory in schools is the point at which he also becomes less and less part of popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
In the 19th century in America, people used to have performances of Shakespeare in bar rooms in mining camps. That's not the sort of thing that goes on anymore. One way of coping with this is to try to update him and to find, you know, sort of analogies between the plays and contemporary experiences. But another way of dealing with it is simply to say, here's a very great writer and thinker. What aspect of his work do you think is still true, is true of human beings, you know, at all times and places? And what aspects of his work are no longer true, are no longer relevant? I mean, if you want to read works that are about the present, there are all sorts of good works written in the present about the present. The attraction of Shakespeare, the interest of Shakespeare, is that he is a major figure from the past, and we can learn from him something both about things that are permanent in human nature, but also about things that have changed.
Do you think one of the problems with Shakespeare and with teaching or reading Shakespeare today is all the sanctimony that has surrounded him because
Yes.
of the way he's been canonized over the centuries?
Yes. This is, again, related to the compulsory aspect of it. Shakespeare, in his own time, was regarded as a very good playwright, but plays were regarded with some of the same mixed feelings that people now have about television programs or about Hollywood films. They're enormously popular. They have a great deal of influence on the way people think in our society. A lot of money is spent on them, and they make a lot of money. But they aren't regarded as high culture for the most part, or usually only the ones that are boring and that nobody wants to go see are regarded as high culture. But the ones that are popular are regarded with some suspicion by mm-hmm. the cultural establishment. And that's the way that Shakespeare was regarded in his own time. So I do think that people regard Shakespeare too reverently, and this is going to happen when he becomes a required part of our culture, the sort of thing that secretaries of state for education say need to be imposed on everybody.
So you don't think Shakespeare should be imposed on students?
I think that it is desirable that they have some exposure to Shakespeare, but it's a question of how much exposure. Anyone who takes an English literature course, for instance, who has some exposure to English literature, you would expect them to read at least one play of Shakespeare and some of the poems. But I don't think that it's more necessary for them to have to have read all of Shakespeare than to have read, say, all of Milton or all of Dickens. There are other important writers, and as long as people who are interested in literature have some exposure to a lot of different writers whom we all agree are important, then people should be able to choose for themselves which ones they find most powerful or the ones that say the most to them. If Shakespeare can't survive because people choose to read him, then you can't legislate cultural permanence. You can't force people to find relevance in Shakespeare if they're actually finding something more important to their own lives in Dickens or Tolstoy or any number of other writers who are out there who are also, you know, geniuses, but who may be more relevant to our times than Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. You've brought out two volumes of the complete works of Shakespeare. One of the volumes was in the original language and the other is in a more modern language. In what ways does the more modern volume have the mark of its time on it? I'm sure you really had to think long and hard about that. But what your edition was going to be like, the edition that you co-edited.
Yes. this is the new edition published by Oxford University Press. It, well, one of the things that I was trying to do as I wrote this book is to think about our own edition in terms of it fitting into its own time in the way that everything everybody else was doing was fitting into its own time. I think that one of the things that makes it characteristic of its time is the very fact that it's attending to language, to semiotics, to all sorts of different verbal, all sorts of different signs beyond just the words themselves. And it's also typical of its time in that it is controversial. It is outrageous in certain ways. We knew when we were working on it that some of the things that we did were going to offend lots of people, putting in two different versions of King Lear, saying that certain of the plays Shakespeare wrote in collaboration with other people, including this poem, Shall I Die, changing the titles of certain plays back from the titles that everyone knows to the titles they had in Shakespeare's own lifetime. So that in its very efforts to get back to the truth about Shakespeare and to give us a new text, it was also upsetting people's ideas about Shakespeare in all sorts of ways. And that very quality of being confrontational and upsetting is very much characteristic of the literary criticism and debate of the 1970s and 1980s.
Is one of the conclusions we should draw by your book, Reinventing Shakespeare, that we really shouldn't accept somebody by their reputation? You know what I mean? That we really
That's
have
right.
to read and rediscover somebody's work and...
Don't believe the marketing people. And in
which
the
is
same
in this case some of the scholars.
Yeah, that's right. In the same way that, you know, when you're dealing with commercial products, you should not believe advertisements. You should not fall for all the hype. In the same way, you should be suspicious of the way that Shakespeare has been marketed. And Shakespeare is now all over the world, but so is Coca-Cola. And the fact that they're all over the place does not mean that we should just accept them as being the best that we can do. We should be suspicious. And I think we should be especially suspicious of anything that is anything where we really feel that it's being hyped. And Shakespeare is being hyped in our culture.
Okay. Gary Taylor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Gary Taylor is the author of Reinventing Shakespeare. It's published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheim is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Today we're going to take another look at Hurricane Hugo and at the difficulty of getting word in or out about what has happened to Puerto Rico. We're going to have a report on the United Nations debate on the rainforest, hear from the Library of Congress, which has just chosen 25 of the greatest American films to preserve. We're going to talk to farmers who grow winter wheat and have had difficulties in recent years. There's some new developments in the Pittston coal strike. And we've learned some things about the old song Louie Louie that you may not know. There's a real sense of swinging and swaying with Louie Louie, and we're going to talk about that.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Cynthia Ozick is one of the foremost American Jewish writers. Her new book, The Shawl, is comprised of a short story and a novella that were originally published in The New Yorker and are both about the same character, a Holocaust survivor named Rosa Lublin. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Textures count as much as ideas in Cynthia Ozick's fiction. The Shawl is a dazzling work of art because of language, no matter what it thinks. The trouble is that Ozick wants us to think. She distrusts the manipulation of feelings by art as performance, art as trickery. In her critical essays, she's fiercely prescriptive. The second commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee a graven image nor any manner of likeness, is as real to her as the book at hand, the face in the mirror, the Jew in history. In these essays, she's an idol smasher. Heads will roll. Ought Jews to be storytellers at all, she asks, corrupting history with image, likeness, magic, miracles. What good is any art so long as they're killers who play Mozart at the gates of Auschwitz? She disdains Mailer and Updike, Nabokov and Virginia Woolf. Of E.M. Forster, she says, his humanity goes from wound to wound. It is the humanism of cripples. It is too thin. The thugs escape. From literature, she demands a certain corona of moral purpose. But in her own fiction, in Bloodshed and The Cannibal Galaxy and The Messiah of Stockholm, she's a shaman, like a Chagall, or like Feingold in her masterpiece Levitation. She dances in the air, full of startling, joyous, darkly funny images, of jumping beans. She's so good at what she warns us against, narratives and suspenses, turning points and palaces, mermen and dragons, that we feel guilty about admiring her, as if for the wrong reasons. The Shawl goes partway toward solving this problem with a horror almost unremitting. The magic in it is dread. We first meet Rosa Lublin in the story in a death camp. Her daughter Magda, whom she's nourished on a cinnamon and almond-scented shawl, is murdered, thrown by a German at an electrified fence. We find Rosa again years later in the novella, alone in Miami. What's happened between the story and the novella is that history itself has been turned into an idol to be smashed. The history of the Holocaust has been co-opted by sociologists who convert human beings into blue digits on the arm, abstractions called survivors, with repressed animation and other neurological residues. Who made up these words, asks Mad Rosa in Miami, parasites on the throat of suffering. She still has the shawl, a holy relic, from which she dreams a grown-up Magda. This, of course, is idolatrous. But so is Rosa's poisoned memory an idol. She thinks of her real life as wartime, the past, stolen from her, like her child. In hiding from Simon Persky, an old man she meets in a laundromat who would restore her to the idea of a future, she is hiding from her sanity. To these disturbing ideas, now add the Ozick texture. We begin to realize, without being bullied, that Rosa's not the only one who's crazy. So is Miami, a kind of theme park for the modern world's forgetfulness and monstrous abstractions. Another sort of death camp, where 70-year-old women are flirts, and men of the same age have turned inward, running their lives in front of their eyes like secret movies. And all of them are scarecrows, blown about under the murdering sunball. Thus Ozick, who went to an American high school during World War II, bears brilliant witness to the death of poetry and the death of reason everywhere.
John Leonard reviewed The Shawl by Cynthia Ozick. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person with assistance from Roberta Sharrock and Ken Hom. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Beating the Air Travel System, George Brown's new book tells you everything from how to find the cheapest fares to how to get away with making love in an airplane. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.